Hello there. For this episode of the Scottish Football Marketing Podcast, we caught up with George Francis from Partick Thistle. We chatted all things PR and media, including what he has done to help media relations with the club. We also talked about working with players and how life is different in the Championship compared to the Premiership. Of course, we couldn't talk to George and not ask about everyone's favourite yellow mascot. This is show 3, and if you haven't managed yet, have a listen to our first two podcasts where we have talked about research and insights and volunteering. You can subscribe to the Scottish Football Marketing Podcast via iTunes and all the usual places. We are very encouraged by all the positive comments and messages we've received. Audience numbers have surpassed our expectations already. You can follow George on Twitter at GeorgeFrancis2, Chris at SportsMarketingSco, and myself at Michael Bockel. Hope you enjoy the show. Welcome to show 3 of the Scottish Football Marketing Podcast with me, Michael Bockel, and Chris Sampson from Sports Marketing Scotland. Delighted to say we've got George Francis on the show this week. He's Media and Communications Manager at Partick Thistle. As we've said before in the podcast, we're going to focus on a topic and bringing the guest on to complement that. This week, we're looking at media relations, working with the press, and obviously looking at what you can do in-house too. So, George, first of all, thanks for joining us.
No problem, happy to be here.
Can you take us through your role at Thistle?
Yeah, so my role's changed a little bit over the last, I've been there for almost 5 years now. When I first came in, it was a new role that had been created because Thistle had made it back at the Premiership, initially to kind of make sure that we were ticking the right SPFL boxes in terms of pre-match press conferences, post-match player appearances, things like that, but obviously with a view to improving things across the board, and was given a pretty blank canvas, which was great. It was your new gaffer, Ian Maxwell at the time, who gave me the chance. So, he was great and did just give us a bit of a blank canvas to go and do things with social media and the programme and the website and all that on top of the kind of initial media relations. So we cracked on with that. We got some successes, some things didn't work out quite so well, and eventually we kind of got an extra member of staff in the media team and we've kicked on again for there. So I'm doing maybe slightly less digital stuff now, but trying to focus more on kind of trying to get some sort of strategy together so that we're all pulling in the same direction with everything, whether it from, you know, the groundsman right the way through to the manager and everybody in between and the board, and everybody knows what the messages are and how we can best kind of get those out. So it's changed a little bit in the last 5 years, but it's all kind of the same kind of stuff. And now, ultimately, anything that comes out for the club comes through me at some point. So whether it's newsletters, or we've just done a launch today, or kind of Junior Jags package, which is a kind of kids under 16s membership package. So all the sign up forms and things for that came through me as well. And it's just a case of trying to help the different people who are all working hard in the club to get their messages and their what they need out there in the best kind of possible way, while keeping it all under the same kind of brand and making sure it's all up to the standards. So yeah, it's a pretty big role, but it's good fun.
Yeah. You've actually been doing something, right? You've been acknowledged by the Football Writers on more than one occasion for your media relations. What is your approach with the media?
I think when I first moved in to the job, I came from a corporate communications background, so I used to work for a company called The Big Partnership, doing corporate comms for a number of different kind of very corporate focused companies. So very, very different to what I do now. At that point, you'd be working for clients and you would be scrapping to try and get sidebars in Herald Business. So, you know, if you got a page lead, it was a really good result. So I came from that background of knowing how valuable coverage could be and how much value organisations and companies place on good press coverage, good positive press coverage that's on message. So when I came to Thistle, I met up with a few journalists to start off with, just to kind of get the lay of the land, and it was pretty clear at that time. I will preface all this with saying that things across Scotland have changed a fair bit in the last 5 years, but at that point a lot of clubs were quite closed to the media. It was quite a tempestuous kind of head-to-head combative almost relationship, and every journalist that I spoke to was very much like, we don't want that, let's try and open it up a little bit. The best thing you can do is open up your doors. I'd read a little bit about kind of what Alan Burrows had done. He was obviously the commander-in-chief in terms of media managers at that point, and I'd read a little bit about what he did and the kind of open door policy he had, and try to operate something similar. Didn't want to close off doors. Obviously there are some requests that we can't accommodate for any number of reasons, but tried to be quite open. And my big thing when I came in was just to say to the guys every time I met them, listen, if you've got a question or you've got a request, ask me. If there's a reason we can't do it, I'm not going to spin you a yarn. I will just tell you, we can't do that because of X, Y, or Z. Or, listen, I can't tell you why we can't do that at this time, but give me a month and I'll be able to explain in more detail and just kind of... And the whole aim was to try and build up a bit of trust, whereby they knew I would do my best to kind of get what they needed, and in return, they would do their best to work with us, whether that be in terms of getting the best kind of messages across for a negative story or promoting whatever we might have on sale at that particular time. So it was very much just trying to operate an open door policy as far as I could, and just be very honest and upfront with the guys when we couldn't do something, and that seemed to go down quite well to start off with. So
would that be your tip for others then as well? We were going to ask about kind of building those relationships, how you built them in the first place, and yeah, how they've progressed over time.
You've hit the nail on the head there. I think like relationships is the biggest thing. Very first thing I did when I got into the job was try to get out and meet a journalist from each of the main papers. Obviously, being where we are, we've got a great relationship with Evening Times, so very quickly I met, it was Chris Jack, who was the kind of Jags man at that point, and met with him to talk about what they needed, and it became quite obvious that there was already a pretty strong relationship there, so it was just a case of cultivating that and trying to keep working with them. I met a few guys, somebody for the Records, I think I met John McGarry for the Mail, and Ronnie Mackay for the Sun as well. So met a few of the guys, just got a good idea of what was going on, and kind of tried to take that into what we did. And as I said at the start, luckily our board was really accommodating in terms of just letting me get on with it and trusting me to kind of go and do it, which was great, because you wouldn't always be in that position, I don't think, in a football club. So that was good.
What would you say the benefits of building those relationships have been kind of over the years?
I think there's so many. I think, I mean, the clear and obvious one is that if you've got a really good relationship with the media when it comes to your kit launch or when it comes to your season ticket launch, I can phone a journalist and say, listen, I need a wee hand with this. Any chance we can, if I give you this player, can you give the season tickets a good push? It's human nature that if you have a good relationship with a person, then you can do that, and you're much more likely, you can have a chat about it, and they're much more likely to get something out of it that kind of mutually benefits both of you. If you don't get on with somebody, I mean, even in everyday life, if you don't get on with somebody, you're not going to ask for a favour. It doesn't work like that. So by building those relationships, you got that. I mean, the other flip side of that, which is that in an organisation like a football club, you are so high profile that you are going to come under scrutiny. There are going to be negative stories. I don't think there's a single club, and probably certainly in Scotland, but across the UK, who hasn't had at some point over the last 5 years a negative story. If you've got relationships with journalists, it's not, I mean, we don't live in the world of the thick of it. It's not like you can pick up the phone and shout and bawl at a journalist and they'll drop the story, but you can have a discussion with them and at the very least make sure that your line is carried and is prominent within the story. And if you've got that relationship, you can have honest discussions with them on or off the record to make sure that that story is reported well and that your response or your line on the story is included prominently. So, I mean, they're the two kind of highest profile ones, but above and beyond that, I've found in this job that it is so much easier just to accommodate people and so much easier to be nice and pleasant. You see, if you can't do, it's harder, in my opinion, it's harder to be difficult to deal with. and I don't mean that, that doesn't impact upon the results. I think, you know, you can still get your results and not be unpleasant to deal with.
I think when the rest of the club, as you've said, are so accommodating as well and are happy to just let you get on with your role,
I think so.
Then that helps massively as well, sure.
Don't get me wrong, there are speed bumps, you know. It's not like you come in and everything goes smooth and you don't get a dodgy headline, you don't get a quote that you wish you could get back. You know, these things happen. The important thing is that when they do happen, you look at why it happened, and if it's an error on your behalf, which obviously it can be, everybody makes mistakes, you go on and take a kind of, you learn from it and move on. If it's an error from the journalist part, again, if you've got a good relationship with them, you can phone them and say, that's not what he said, or I think that headline's misleading, and have an adult conversation about it. You know, it's not difficult. You go and have a proper conversation with them and normally get a resolution pretty quickly. But yeah, there's so many benefits to having that relationship. They're probably just a handful, but and they affect other areas by varying degrees. But yeah.
You, we kind of touched on it as well. You're one of four SPFL clubs in Glasgow, with two of the biggest ones, on your doorstep, yep, almost as well. How do you position Partick Thistle in that?
It's normally one of the first questions I get if I meet somebody and they ask me who I do, who I work for, or what I do, and I'm the media manager for Partick Thistle. After I explain where Partick Thistle is and who the club is, they normally ask about Celtic and Rangers and how difficult does that make things. And do you know what? It is what it is. There's no point in grumping and moaning about it. Celtic and Rangers have a presence all over Scotland. You know, you'll go to a Dundee United game and you'll see Celtic and Rangers shirts. You'll go to games just about all over the country. Yes, it's probably magnified in for us. In fact, it certainly is magnified for us. But it's there's no point in us trying to go and compete. There's no point in us trying to go and take Celtic fans away for Celtic. It's never going to happen. So what we need to do is create our own identity, our own image, and our own kind of character as well, which I think we've done pretty well, particularly over the last 3 or 4 years. We've really crafted a kind of pretty strong identity for us. And then from there, it's just about building on that with everything that we do and trying to make Thistle a club that people want to come and support. People want to come to match days, and there's all sorts of different ways we're looking at kind of match day experience at the moment, and there's lots of different things that we do or that we try to do that will hopefully kind of build on that character. But I'm quite a firm believer, and you can only be what you are. You can't change you've just got to play to your strengths, and our strengths are that we aren't one of the old firm. We are quite individual and we have a lot of character, and I think you see that in the stuff that we do. So
how does that play out in terms of like the PR and media coverage like across the city? Do you try and marry that up with that image as well?
Definitely. I think it's all about two or three years ago it was kind of linked in with when we launched Kingsley. You might have heard of him. When we launched Kingsley, we at that point made a real conscious effort to sit down and talk about what is it that we, how do we want to be seen, what are our key messages for this season or for 2 seasons or for 5 seasons or whatever it is. That coincided with Jackie Lowe coming onto the board, who's now our chairman as of 3 or 4 weeks ago. And obviously she has a communications background, so she really gave me the clout at board level. Not the clout at board level, that makes it sound like I wasn't being listened to before, but she gave me a bit more support at board level to really make this a focus for everybody. And we distilled it down to a number of 3 or 4 words, ambitious, stable, these kind of words. Community-based was one of them. And that all kind of culminated in the We Are Thistle campaign and the Not So Cuddly Anymore campaign, and it was a conscious effort to move away from, oh, that's Partick Thistle in the corner. You know, the cuddly toy of Scottish football was quite often the phrase that was kind of used in association with, oh, Thistle, ah, they're great, we'll go see them once or twice a season, support that club, you know, and moved away from that to being, actually, you know what, we've now been in the Premiership for, I think at that point it was 3 seasons, 2 or 3 seasons, we're here to stay, we're a properly well-run club, and that took us into a season where we went debt-free for the first time, and you know, we made some really serious announcements that where we were, you know, regardless of where we end up at the end of the season on the pitch, we are a serious outfit offer, and we really try to push that through our messaging, and it's something we've continued to do to a greater or lesser degree. Obviously, when you're flying on the pitch, it takes care of itself more or less. Last season was tougher, but this season I think we've come out again really strongly with a quite a strong identity this year in terms of what our aims are and where we want to be come the end of the season. So it's getting back to that kind of quite strong message, I think.
Don't want to dwell on it too much, but obviously this time last season, just come off the top six finish. Obviously you hinted it there that things got a bit tough last season, now having to adjust to life in the Championship. What, from your point of thing, is the sort of biggest differences and challenges you're facing as dropping down the division?
I think that there's a lot of differences and there's a lot of similarities. We are still getting, well, I personally am still getting to grips with how our media relations work is going to shape up this season. We're obviously at the moment midway through the Betfred campaign, and when we get the league campaign started depend. I think a lot of the interest in us will depend very much on performance. We're lucky in that we're Glasgow based, and it makes it a lot easier for journalists to come and cover us from a purely logistical point of view. So that side of things, there's a bit of kind of wait and see. Obviously, there's the big obvious ones are things like telly. You know, we're not on the telly, not on sports scene, where you don't get as many live games, albeit kind of Alba have got a certain assignment and BT can pick up a handful of games, but it's very different. But the focus for us just switches to really pushing our own messages, looking at our kind of in-house TV service, where that now, you know, JagZone is the only place that you can get the highlights. So that, for all it's really disappointing to not be in the Premiership, that becomes a greater asset to us, because if a Thistle fan wants to see goals at Thistle every week, they can't just tune in to BBC and watch Jonathan Sutherland talk through it. It has to be through us. So that's a benefit that we've got to make the most of. Our social media presence, we're looking at how we rejuvenate that and go again with that, because, you know, having that maybe slightly less media kind of constraints on us or time constraints on us, and we can then go and focus on that. And again, we focus on how we get better at talking to our own fans directly. So the focus changes, but there's plenty that stays the same as well. And the way we do things and the messages that we get across will still hopefully be strong. So
definitely an opportunity in some ways.
Oh, 100%. And for all it was grim. It was grim. There's no getting away from it. The Sunday we got relegated was horrific. Any Thistle fan will tell you that. Everybody in the office, it was awful. The Monday and the Tuesday were not great either. The Wednesday we announced the manager was staying, and suddenly you could see people like visibly starting to get excited. The manager stayed, we started to get an idea of what the squad was going to look like, which players were going to stay. You could see people walking around the office getting more excited and really starting to look forward to the season. It's, you know, and that's really continued. And as you say, there are challenges, but we've managed to retain the vast majority of our sponsors this year, which is absolutely brilliant. That support helps us no end. We've managed to, you know, season ticket sales have been going pretty well. We've managed to keep all of our staff in the office, which is absolutely brilliant. And slowly but surely, we are those opportunities, once you kind of get over that initial disappointment, the opportunities do start opening up, and there's no point in dwelling on it. We are where we are. We just need to focus on what we do next and where we go next and what we can do, what we can each do to kind of help us get out of that league at the first time you ask him, and crack on from there. And as I said, things like JagZone, it opens up other opportunities for us to go and do stuff with different areas, and it's just a case of adjusting how we look at things, really.
I think you've seen other clubs as well like suffer a bit of pain in terms of relegation and go on to, and like you said as well, really galvanise themselves. Like, it took Hibs obviously a few seasons to come up, but in that time club changed massively off the pitch, and now they're kind of reaping the benefits of that.
Yeah.
Same as Dunfermline as well. Obviously they were down in League One, back up to the Championship now for the last couple of seasons, and the same, like, I think they're getting kind of record fans, mm-hmm. Obviously not record, but over the last couple of seasons, then fans are really flocking back to East End Park.
100%. Listen, as I say, it's disappointing, but we've just got to make the most of what we are, and if that means, you know, really going and trying to do things a bit differently or taking these opportunities that we've now got and really making the most of them. I mean, I'm a Newcastle fan, and Newcastle got relegated the first time. It was the club was needed to be relegated. It went down, freshened everything up and came back, and it felt like a better club. It felt like it had a real kind of
fans get behind it.
It had an identity to it. The same this time, we got relegated, came back up last season. You know, the place felt good. It felt really positive. One of the most positive games I've been to at St James's in recent years was the final game when we got relegated and we beat Spurs on the last day of the season. But the place was absolutely bouncing, because people kind of knew that, yeah, it's going to be tough next season, but it's a good chance to kind of renew and regenerate. And I'm not saying that was necessarily what we needed at Thistle, but it's certainly, nobody's treating it as the end of the world. It's disappointing, but there are so many opportunities for us, and we need to just make sure we are all from top to bottom doing what we can to kind of get us back to the top flight, because at the end of the day, that's where everybody wants to be. So
definitely. Obviously, community's at the heart of a lot of clubs in Scotland. Mm-hmm. You touched on it earlier, Partick Thistle's no different as being one of the sort of pillars. What sort of role does PR and media play in this
sort of Thistle's community's efforts?
I think it's an interesting one. The community and the idea of kind of local identity, I think, is one of the things that gives Scottish football, what makes Scottish football unique, or certainly gives it an edge on English football. English football, I mean, to go and engage with players at Newcastle, you need to either spend a fortune, get very lucky and be, you know, subscribe to one of their young junior Magpies packages or whatever. There's such a distance between the clubs and the players. Now, that's to a greater or lesser degree. You hear all sorts of great stories about, you know, Leicester players getting involved with local communities and things like that. And there are absolutely 100% standout examples down south. But I think that closeness to the community up here is something that really is an asset to Scottish football, and just how accessible most of the players are and the clubs are as a whole. How you use communications and PR, I think any kind of communication, any kind of PR is just about telling a story that is attractive and that, you know, either pulls on the heartstrings or motivates people or tells a good story about how the club's connected. And it's all about how you tell that tale, if you like. That's the number one thing when it comes to that kind of stuff. I don't think, you know, I think we've had some successes in that area. It's probably an area we need to work harder at. But you've seen the likes of Kilmarnock and Motherwell in recent years. Some of the stuff Motherwell did around, you know, their steel identity and some of the video content, which is always superb out of that club. That grounds clubs in the community. It doesn't all have to be visiting schools and things like that to be something to do with the community. It's maintaining that connection. Having said that, we are really stepping it up now. We last season employed Beth Adamson, who's our support engagement officer at Thistle. So she's been taking players out more and more out to schools, and we're looking to link in with school curriculums to do more educational work and really make Thistle part of the lives of school kids in the local area. Now, there's an argument that it's probably not PR, but it is communication. We're talking to our local area, we're building those, it goes back to what we were talking about earlier on, builds those relationships, and the hope is that we start getting those young generations kind of indoctrinated. It's probably a negative word, but it's not far off that, you know, we make this a part of their lives from an early stage and try and get them into that community. We've done Kids Go Free for 8 or 9 years now, you know, completely free tickets for children, but we need to get that message out because there's still people who don't know we do it. So it's getting that message out to kids. It's targeting different groups and to a certain extent having those groups do a bit of the work for us as well. If we can spread that kind of positivity around from the club, then they'll go on and do that for us. So in terms of communications and PR in the community work that we do, it's not all press releases and Twitter and website stories, but it is all communication and it is all building relationships. So it's that, from that point of view and from telling that story, it's very important.
You mentioned players obviously playing a role in that. How difficult or how do you go about working with players, especially, and not to be stereotypical or anything, but modern day players who can be a bit, well, awkward or not wanting to do sort of these sort of things?
You sometimes feel like a bit like Del Boy, trying to kind of wheel and deal them to get, if you do press this week, I'll take you off doing that appearance that week. Or I mean, there's a bit of that, and different players are different people, but I am very fortunate in that I have not had many difficult players at all. We've had challenging personalities, you might say. You've had guys who are motivated by different things, guys who are absolutely desperate to do everything that you can send their way, guys who are a bit shyer, who only do certain stuff. It goes back to what we were talking about before, it's relationships. It's knowing that player X is perfectly happy to do press but hates doing video interviews, or it's knowing that player Y is quite happy to go and do some match commentary when they're injured but would give you, you know, the keys to his car not to have to go and do hospitality after a game. So it's knowing what everybody's comfortable doing, because at the end of the day, if they're really uncomfortable at doing something, they're not going to be very good at it. They're going to be rubbish. So it's about getting the most out of the players and just talking to them like they're human. You know, like, you wouldn't expect in your daily work, you wouldn't expect somebody to come up to you and say, right, you've got a meeting in 5 minutes, get down there. It's about talking to them, planning with them, and just treating them like adults, which is difficult sometimes, but most of the time, you know, it's just about treating them with a bit of respect, and generally speaking, the kind of old golden rule, if you like. If you talk to them like you would expect to be talked to, you know when to get what you need at some point or another. But there is a bit of wheeler dealing at times. It does take a bit of kind of arm twisting, and yeah, trying to get them to do stuff can be tricky, but yeah, generally speaking, it's not too bad.
Definitely happens at all levels. We have that same wheel and dealing going on when any time I try to get them to do something even remotely different.
Yeah, 100%. And it is just trying to get them comfortable doing it. I mean, you've got to remember, I came into the club at a time when they just got promoted from the Championship, so the amount of press that they had to do was really limited. So I had a squad full of players who all of them hated doing the press because they'd never done it. You see, by the end of the first season, everybody was pretty happy doing it. By the end of the second season, there was quite a lot of them were actually coming to me to ask, can I do this interview or can I do press that day? And again, it's just comfort. It's just guys getting comfortable with it and getting used to it. And that's the same as anything, you know. Anybody's out of their comfort zone, they need a bit of time to adjust and get used to what they're doing. So, but yeah, you just talk to them like they're adults and have conversations with them, and you tend to get what you want eventually.
Do you guys have formal media training at Park?
We do bits and pieces. I tend to do once or twice a year, I'll go into an academy session and work with, just do a bit of a presentation to the academy kids and the parents of the academy kids as well. That's more focused on social media than kind of actual media training. The social media aspect of it is obviously so important now, because it literally is the case that a couple of badly timed tweets or badly judged tweets can kill a career. Like it is that kind of level that we're talking about. So that we get in with all age groups and we engage with the players themselves right the way through the age groups. But what I find just as important is engaging with the parents, and because a lot of the time the parents aren't educated on social media. They don't. I mean, I'm coming up 30 in August, and I consider myself to not be a kind of core social media user, because the guys who are younger than me, 5 or 6 years younger than me, are going to be far more up to date with social media than I'll ever be. I'll always be playing catch up to them because they've grown up with it. And likewise, you know, you can have the most kind of social media switched on parent, they're not going to be as switched on as their kids are. So some of it is just educating the parents and educating them in terms of just how impactful this can be. In terms of media training, it's something we should do more of. It's probably something we'll look to do a bit more of this year. What we tend to do is work with the under-20s team in terms of doing our own in-house video stuff, getting them used to doing that. I've certainly noticed a difference since we started doing that for more regularly for under-20s, that guys have started to get more comfortable with it, so that when we do end up doing journalist interviews with them, they do come across a bit more comfortable. That's kind of anecdotal, but I mean, Liam Lindsay was a good example. He'll do a lot of press down south now, but when he first came through the 20s squad, you'd be lucky to get 6 words out of him. But we worked with him and got him to relax, and once you're relaxed in front of one camera being asked questions, yes, it's a jump to be asked questions by 6 or 7 guys and some have photo flashes going off at the same time, but it's a smaller step than not having done anything. So that kind of helps, and we just build it up. As I said earlier, we've got a great relationship with Evening Times, so we'll tend to do kind of one-to-one interviews with Evening Times to break them into it. So again, it's just taking kind of gradual steps. So we don't do as much formal media training as we should, but I think we do kind of give the guys a bit of a gradual introduction to it. So, and that tends to work.
We're the same. We're looking at a lot of sort of what can we do with our youth players, and I know you mentioned about players missing out and stuff, and I think people don't actually generally realise, but players have missed out on moves in the past because of what they've tweeted.
Yeah.
So it's a big sort of education piece there, and it's also looking at the opportunities and how players can build their own sort of personalities and brands as well. So it's a two-side thing. And I suppose talking about shifting in media and social media and stuff like that, what's your view on the sort of shift in media, and it's a phrase I hate, but towards the new media sort of side of things, and as opposed to sort of the traditional media like newspapers?
I think it's a really interesting time, not just for sport, I think, or maybe touch on it later in terms of like actual in-house club media. I think that the relationship between them and the traditional media is really interesting, but the relationship between the bigger relationship between traditional media, social media, digital media, is absolutely fascinating at the moment, and not just from but from a kind of communications professional background, I find it really interesting. I think the best examples of new media and traditional media is when they work together. And again, even then, there's not a huge number of examples of that. But if you can get a good written publication with excellent digital content that goes alongside it, it is very complementary, because it's not that, you know, it's unlikely that if somebody follows, I mean, take somebody like 442 or World Soccer or one of these magazines, I wouldn't necessarily say that they're the absolute pinnacle of social media, but the likelihood is that if you're really paying attention to their tweets and social media and really enjoy their tweets and social media, at some point you're going to buy the magazine. And I think there's this real thing that social media is going to take over newspapers, social media is going to take over printed media. I don't see why that needs to happen. I accept that there are hurdles to overcome. It's going to be a challenging time for newspapers, but they should be looking at each other and going, this is a match made in heaven, and we need to get better at exploiting that. I mean, social media is absolutely fantastic for clubs. We were talking before we started about, you know, clubs with smaller budgets and how trying to give them advice on how to make the most of what they've got. Well, social media is a perfect example. You don't need to pay for Twitter, you don't need to pay for Facebook. We use Hootsuite as a management software on social media, and there is a subscription fee, but it's nominal. But you can get by without that. We use that because it makes our lives easier. But you can get by without that. And yet, even the smallest clubs in the country with the lowest budgets could reach thousands of people in a way that just wasn't possible 30 years ago. It just wasn't possible. And that, I think, it's so valuable for clubs. And again, like anything, like media relations, like anything, you see a full spectrum of people who use it really well and people who use it really not well. but some of the ideas are absolutely superb, whether it's video content or wee quizzes, or I love seeing and subsequently stealing ways that different clubs use social media in new and innovative ways. And it's great when you'll know this yourself, it's great when you see something and go, I've never even thought of using that way. What a great idea that is. And then go and use it yourself, because that's what everybody does. Cool. Everybody does. So, yeah, it's crucial. I think, as I say, I think the relationship between new media and traditional media is going to be difficult. It's going to take a bit of time to settle down. But in terms of digital media for clubs and digital media for sports, even governing bodies, it's such a valuable tool that can be used for very, very limited budget. And even when you start looking at advertising, I mean, we've just started looking at social media advertising for the first time. And, you know, the bang for your buck you can get from a small Facebook campaign, you can spend buttons, 20 quid, and get a decent return. If you want to go and spend 100 quid, you know, for a club of our size, never mind, you know, clubs in lower leagues than us, you can get such good bang for your buck. And again, I guess that is a conflict with the newspapers, because why would you go and spend thousands of pounds on an advert in a tabloid when you could go and spend a couple of hundred and probably reach more people that are directly involved with you? So
yeah, it's definitely paid social advertising, especially. I think we're going to do a podcast on that, because it is quite a big thing.
Definitely.
We see benefits from the activity we do, and I think, as you said, it's probably for a lot of clubs an untapped space that they can work in.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, like, we are only just really scratching the surface at the moment, but it is something that I think with very limited knowledge, you don't have to be an expert in social media to be able to put together a well crafted, you know, social media advertising campaign. You only need to go through the Facebook one once. It literally talks you through it. Like, you know, it explains every step of the way. And you can, I mean, there's so many case studies now of different clubs or organisations that have seen such good, you know, feedback from social media advertising, and because of its economy, I guess, because of how little it costs, it's not like you need to pick it and go, right, I can only use this for my season tickets. You can use it if you're doing, like what you were talking about last week, insights. So if you're looking to do surveys, or you can plan a proper good campaign across the course of your season for a fraction of what you might have had to pay 25 years ago, 20 years ago, 10 years ago even. So, no, it's an interesting area.
Looking at the reach between the two, how does that compare?
I think it's a difficult one because, generally speaking, your social media is going to be much more targeted to people who are interested in what you have to sell,
yeah,
essentially. Now, I am very much of the opinion, as I said earlier on, that there is a space, there is enough room in this world for there to be traditional media advertising, traditional media content, and new media advertising and new media content. There's, you know, they are not mutually exclusive, and I think there is space for both of them. And it's just about targeting the right campaign, the right messages on the right format. So often we've got season tickets, let's go and advertise in X paper, let's go and advertise on those billboards or in the subway. And it's, well, I mean, why? Is that who we want to speak to? If it is, great, let's attribute a budget and let's go and do it. Is it who we want to speak to? Or would we actually be better going and spending that much and speaking to our Twitter followers or our Facebook followers and doing something more targeted? Or are we actually better emailing people or traditional mailing people? You've got, I think the way I look at it, the way we try to look at it, is that you've got this suite of different ways to talk to people, and it's about picking the right ones for the right messages or the right purpose. When I first started in the job, quite often you would get a story and it's like, right, it's really important that we get good coverage on this. And I think it's so important to ask, well, what is good coverage? If you're wanting something to be seen by as many people in Scotland as possible, let's get it out to as many people, different people in Scotland, and put it on all platforms. If you're wanting Thistle fans to read it, let's do an exclusive piece with the Evening Times and get a better chunk of coverage that is still on message, and support that with social media. Because although that might be reaching fewer overall people, it's reaching the people we want to speak to. So going back to what you were talking about in terms of audience, yes, I mean, we don't compete with the Sun's reach. We're never going to sell as many programmes as the Daily Record sells papers. But if we want to speak to our supporters, it's much more effective for us to go and speak to our supporters through our channels than it is to go and speak to the Daily Record to speak to our supporters who may or may not read the paper. So again, they've got more numbers so they must be better, or we've got fewer numbers so we must be better. It's about picking the right method to get your message or achieve the point that you're trying to get. And that's a question that you've got to constantly ask yourselves. Is this the best way to do that? Is there a better mode to get this message out there? Or actually, is that the best one? And then you get into the question of budget and how you deal with it from there, I think.
That probably leads us quite nicely onto the in-house media.
Yeah.
I think we probably know your views on it's potentially not diminishing the importance of traditional media. We've already touched on that quite a bit, but kind of what's your views on the massive shift that I think I've seen anyway in terms of moving to in-house media?
Definitely. I think there has been a big shift. And I think, again, similar to what we were talking about before, I think it's a period of real transition. But, as I said, not wanting to sit on the fence, I think there is space in the world for both. I completely understand with bigger clubs, whether it be Celtic or clubs down south, that our in-house media is a decent revenue generator for us, but it's nowhere near what Celtic TV will be or what, you know, MUTV will be down south. Of course it's not. And I get that they have a bigger reason to keep exclusive, and that they've got more clout to be able to do that. But I think there's a balance to be achieved. And we've had challenges with getting a balance in terms of, you know, if somebody scores, I mean, take the Betfred game at the weekend, this young lad Stora scores an absolute screamer. Of course, everybody wants to speak to him. But it's then about, right, well, how do we do this? I don't really want to say to the press you can't have them, because that's not very reasonable. I also don't want to say to our in-house team you can't have them, because that's also unreasonable, you know, and we've got, there's different people that you need to try and keep happy. But it's then just about balancing it. Well, when are the papers going to use the interview? What are they going to ask him about? Well, realistically, see, after a Betfred Cup game, even if you scored a screamer, it's not going to be a flowing interview. It's not going to be a, you know, front page of goals in the Sun. It's going to be 100 words, 200 words. So in that instance, right, well, we can very safely use him in Jag Zone, the papers can use him, everybody's happy, it's not a problem. And it's just about getting that balance and, again, being reasonable, trying to talk to people and get where the boundaries are, if you like. Because one of the first conversations we had, or I had with the press guys when we first looked to launch Jagzone, was, right, well, does it actually matter to you if we put up to 500 people a video interview with the same person you've got in the paper? And quite often the answer was, not really. You know, if you film the press conference and put up what we talk to him about as we talk, well, yeah, that's a problem, because you're getting everything that we're doing. If you're doing a completely separate interview, then it's probably not that much of a problem, because we've had for years the BBC do a separate interview with a player or with a manager to the papers. That's just the way it is. So it's about, again, trying to let people know that it's going to happen, so that it's not a surprise when they file a copy and something goes up online, but also trying to work out where those boundaries are. What can we do and it not affect? And then where do those come into conflict? And just trying to work together. Because I do think there's space in this world for us both. But it is going to be it is currently and will continue to be a bit of a kind of learning process for both sides, I think. And it would be really interesting to see how it goes, because at the moment, as much as I say that, you look at the likes of Man United, you look at the likes of Juventus, you look at the biggest clubs in the world, and you do wonder, at what point are they going to go, do you know what, we don't need you guys? And whether that is something that's going to happen, whether that relationship can still remain kind of mutually beneficial, I don't know. I'm very much of the opinion that if you've got newspaper coverage, external coverage gives you an air of legitimacy. In terms of that, you know, I can write and put something on the website, but that doesn't give it any legitimacy, because I could have just written it. You guys will know this yourselves. You know, if you've got an interview in a paper, it lends it some strength, in terms of there has been a bit of a process there. A journalist has asked some questions. It has some sort of kind of independent legitimacy, and I think that's really important. And that, as much as club TV, club media can give insight and can give, you know, can give access, it probably can't quite give that level of kind of...
It's a bit of objectivity.
Objectivity
isn't it?
Is the word I'm looking
for. I didn't want to say bias or propaganda. Yeah. Like,
oh, yeah. We joke sometimes about in-house propaganda and that side of things, but you're right. You put it out into something else and it is getting seen a bit more objectively, because it is an independent party that's looking at that, yeah, whatever that story may be or the line may be, and not us doing what it is.
Yeah, and I think it's healthy as well, and it's healthy for your relationship, going back to what we said right at the start, it's healthy for your relationship with the press, with the media, because you can, if you shut up all shops, you see, as soon as something bad happens to your club or you're in trouble in terms of results, the press are, it's human nature, as I said earlier on, the press are going to jump on you, they're not going to give you that support that you might otherwise have had. So for me, it's always going to be a case of trying to find that balance. But as I say, it's going to be an interesting time. It'll be interesting to see where we are in 10 years.
Just talking about interesting times and how that shift from traditional media, obviously you're seeing more and more, especially within Scottish football, guys like Talking Balls pop up. The Terrace podcast has been on the go for a few years now. That sort of shift to digital only side of things, do you guys, even fan podcasts, obviously, and fan media is becoming quite big, especially at certain clubs, do you guys do anything in that space? Forgive me, I'm not aware of part official fan podcasts or anything like that sort of thing, but is that a space that you guys are keeping an eye on or doing anything in that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a big fan of podcasts, regardless, you know, I've got my phone's filled with them, and I think I find them really interesting. Right the way from the kind of BBC, like Kermode and Mayo, kind of top class, well produced podcasts, right the way down to a couple of fans in a boozer talking about a game. I mean, Thistle does have what it's called, Jagscast, the one that it's kind of tends to be the most regular and most listened to Thistle fans podcast. I think it's just a kind of natural progression. When I first started working at Thistle, everybody was talking about forums being dead and fanzines being dead. Well, they're not. They've just changed. They've just changed to social media accounts and podcasts. That's, you know, that's the reality. Fans always want to have their say. Fans always want to get together and have other people listen to what they have to say. You know, it's I can totally, totally accept that, and I can totally kind of sympathise with that point of view. And some of them are great. Like, there's some really good, really, really good digital content out there, whether it be the likes of Talking Bows or Old Fun Facts. I mean, Old Fun Facts are absolutely superb on Twitter a lot of the time. And I mean, my favourite at the moment is Simpsons SPFL. I don't know if you follow Simpsons SPFL.
It's a mass follow.
Yeah, absolutely brilliant. And that, you know, that's their just Twitter accounts. But again, every club in the country will have podcasts or blogs or whatever it is. And some of the content's absolutely superb. And it helps to kind of generate that. I think it helps generate that community feel. And I listen to them because I'm interested to hear what people say. And I think other people listen to them because they want somebody to disagree with, or they are interested in what whatever. There's a whole load of different reasons why people listen to
them.
As
a club, do you look to try and do anything with the fans' podcast or anything?
Not really. Kind of our approach has always been just to kind of let them get on with it. I think when it comes to that, there is a danger that you kind of muddy the waters a little bit. I mean, if they ever asked, you know, somebody to go on, or I think Jazzcast have spoken to players before and stuff. I don't mind that, but as soon as it becomes, you know, us working more proactively with them, I think they're great in what they are. They are a fan run podcast, fan run digital media. I'm quite happy for them to keep going with that. If we want to do something similar, we maybe look to do it in house. But I think it is quite important to still keep that distance, not distance, but keep those two things quite separate, in the same way that fanzines, you know, fanzines were quite a separate thing, forums were quite a separate thing. You wouldn't get clubs going onto forums and posting and engaging with every post, I don't think. But
just reading secretly
yeah. So it's a difficult balance to get, but no, I think, yeah, long live the fan podcast. I'm a big fan.
Just quickly before we move on, I wanted to touch on England's World Cup. Obviously, it's a Scottish football podcast, but I think from the outside looking in, it obviously showed the kind of power of getting a positive image created and running with that and kind of reinforcing it across messaging, the internal messaging from their social media accounts, external with the media as well. What lessons do you think can be learnt from that tournament from England's point of view and brought into the Scottish football?
It's really interesting because, in a way, I am a walking, talking case study to prove the success of England's kind of comms strategy, if you like, because I mean, I grew up, the first tournament I remember with England, and it was 96, and that team was filled half with Newcastle players. It had, albeit sometimes for the wrong reasons, it had a bit of attitude and personality about it. Gazza, you know, it had something about it, and I enjoyed watching that. And that extended to a certain extent to World Cup 98. And don't get me wrong, I've always liked watching England in a tournament. I think everybody gets caught up with the World Cup and the Euros. But definitely after 98, interest in the England team kind of waned and disappeared to the point where at the last tournament, I wasn't even that bothered about watching England. I would rather have watched, if there was a clash between England and a Spain game, I'd be watching the Spain game. And this tournament, it's gradually kind of built over the last, since they qualified. I think Gareth Southgate's been very, very clever, because I think a lot of it comes from him. A lot of it comes from the, as I understand it, it comes from the FA's comms department as well, and just working closely with the manager and trying to do things a little bit different. By all accounts, they've been much more open with the media than they have been in previous tournaments. Their social media stuff, I mean, how good's, if you can't appreciate a load of multi-millionaires playing around on rainbow flamingos in a swimming pool, you're just not trying hard enough. Like, but stuff like that humanises.
Take a note of that one.
humanises the players. And do you know what it does? It goes back to what we said before about it makes them more identifiable with, you see, if they've just won a game, they want to go and mess about. Not in a bad way, not in a stood next to a Lamborghini kind of way. I think there is an element of that. You start to identify with them, you start to know who they are, you start to see their personalities. And when the guys come out and they're not afraid to say how they feel about the game that's just been, or that they're hurting, or whatever aspect it is. And I think how they manage to do that And it goes again, it's about having that integrated communication strategy that covers every aspect. So it's got social media, it's got digital, it's got press, it's got players on social media, it's got video content, it's got photographic content. And the success of it is no more greatly kind of displayed than the fact that Marks and Spencer's got so on board with a waistcoat. You know, if that, all that comes from a solid, I'm not saying that the communication department and Gareth Southgate sat down and went, right, we're going to do this communication strategy to sell that waistcoat. But all that kind of positive feeling and it all adds together to get your sponsors on board, to generate this good feeling right the way through a country, to the extent where for the first time, I've lived in Glasgow for 12 years, for the first time ever, I was talking to people and going, do you know what, I don't want England to win the World Cup, but I wouldn't mind if they got the semis, you know, which I never, ever heard that before. And I think it was a real success, and it'll be interesting to see if they're able to carry it on outside of a tournament environment and how they do, because I think for the likes of yourselves and Scottish FA and national teams, but also clubs, just how much of a success that was, I think is a really good, a real eye-opener. And I also think what's interesting is, I wonder if a few managers will be watching that, a few kind of media-shy managers who traditionally have said, the media don't matter, or I've not got any interest in engaging with the media, or I'll do the bare minimum, looking at the way Southgate did it and the way Southgate really embraced it and was central to that whole success, and they might just be looking at it and going, do you know what, even up in Scotland, maybe we can engage a little bit more, and maybe we will get some good positives out of it as well.
Oh no, definitely. I think you saw the benefits, even when there was that wee wobble with the leaked team sheet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, and it looked like it could have just gone back, and it was like that house of cards, but it continued on, and England stuck with their messaging and the objective of what they were trying to do with it all, and kind of just brushed that one off, where in the past, clubs will batten down the hatches, yeah, and that's it, sort of game over, you've ruined it for yourself sort of thing. Yeah. But I think you're right, you would hope there is managers and even chief execs across the country looking at that going, I'll tell you what, there's lessons to be learned there, and is there anything we can do?
Especially when the sponsors do start getting on board. You know, that's the absolute holy grail, is that you create something.
It's a bottom line on it.
Absolutely, that you create something like that, and sponsors everywhere, right across the country, whether it was, you know, I think Aldi were involved, and Marks & Spencer, we were spoken about. All over the country, they started getting more and more involved, and that is the holy grail for a communications department, really, is that starts happening. Now, there probably was an element of a perfect storm in that the England team weren't expected to do very well, so the media were slightly less full on, at least until they got to the group stages, than usual. And there were different elements to it. It was a young, likeable squad, young, likeable manager. It's been a successful qualifying campaign, good group, good route, potentially to the latter stages of the tournament. So there was a lot of factors that are going for them. But it's no coincidence. You know, these things don't just happen. They take a lot of work and a lot of time. And it was really good. Kind of national allegiances aside, it was really good to see that approach work so well, I think. And there's a lot of lessons can be learned from that.
Gives us hope to us all working in this industry.
Indeed, yeah.
You mentioned him earlier. We can't go a podcast without mentioning the big man himself, Kingsley.
Yeah.
Do you want to, for those that maybe are not familiar with the story about how he came about and how yous have done that?
Is it anybody?
That's
not.
Here, you never know.
Kingsley was, I mean, I tweeted, I think, a week after we launched him, that I was kind of caught between being really happy and really disappointed, because a big part of me knew that I would never be involved with something like that again, which sounds ridiculous considering we're talking about a 7-foot yellow sun with a monobrow. But I mean, the whole thing was incredible. It's a great story. So it started off, David Shrigley, who is the designer of Kingsley as a kind of, as an artist, he's done bits and pieces for The Guardian. He had the fifth plinth down in London for a while. And he's a big Thistle fan. He moved to Glasgow to go to the Glasgow School of Art and fell in love with the club when he was there. Anyway, this gentleman, Mike Wilkins, who was the kind of head guy at a kind of hedge fund investment firm in California called Kingsford Capital Management, had arranged to meet David Shrigley. We do get to Thistle in a minute and Kingsley. had arranged to meet David before an art exhibition in Chicago. They got chatting. Mike has a big kind of sporting background. He was a stakeholder in Golden State Warriors, and he's got various different kind of interests in sport and just loves sport, I think, as well. They got chatting about the exhibition and got into sport, and David Shrigley started waxing lyrical about Thistle, and I think about kind of Kids Go Free, and just about the kind of nature of the club, perennial underdogs, city with two of the biggest clubs in this country, etc., etc. Mike, it piqued Mike's interest for whatever reason, and more or less, I think he kind of phoned the club a couple of days later, spoke to Maxi, and agreed a front of shirt sponsorship deal. I don't think Maxi probably thought his Christmases had all come at once. But yeah, from there, traditionally one of the aspects of the main sponsorship deal at Thistle was to design and brand the mascot, and that was no different. So it came down, Mike said he wanted David Shrigley to design it. He designed Kingsley. We saw kind of models that were maybe 10 or 15 centimetres tall, and even then we only saw them as photos. And the day we were launching the sponsorship deal, we took delivery of Kingsley. Now, there was already we'd managed to get quite a lot of interest in the deal, because it was an American financial services company investing in Scottish football. It was a good tale as well, going back to what we were talking about before in terms of stories. Already it's a right good story in terms of how it's come about. And when the outfit arrived, me and Maxi looked at it and went, do you know what? Sky Sports will love that. BBC will love that. The photographers will love that. That's great. Gives a bit of colour. And that was it. I wish I could have said, we knew immediately it was going to be a viral sensation.
Little did you know.
Yeah, we just kind of thought, it'll go. The broadcasters will like it. It's something a bit different. I'd had a chat with the guys at Sky about a week earlier about how we need a bit of colour in all our pieces and all that kind of stuff. And it's like, well, I'll keep them happy. And we went through the press. Ian did a bit of press. Mike Wilkins did a bit of press. David did a bit of press. And I was taking them through that. And then they were away doing pictures. And we tweeted, you know, welcome Kingsford Capital Management. Here's Kingsley, our new mascot. And a picture of the big guy. And that was it. And because there was three people doing press and there was quite a lot of interest anyway, it took me a while to get everybody through. And Laura Brannan, who was formerly STV, came over to me and said, George, have you seen Twitter? I was like, no. And she showed me, and she flicked through our Twitter and literally just flicked through our timeline, and every other tweet just about was something to do with Kingsley. You know, the famous one of him shooting fire out his mouth like Godzilla. There was Lisa Simpson comparisons, and I was like, all right, okay. Got back to my desk, and I, even at that stage, that was an hour after the tweet, maybe a couple of hours after the tweet, and I had emails from the BBC, The Telegraph, The Guardian, CNN, Fox News. This is like an hour, 2 hours after, and it was amazing. Like, and it just went and went and went from there. We were on, you know, I was on Five Live talking about it. It featured in publications from just about literally every corner of the world. It was in Australia, it was in Dubai, it was in a paper in Malta, as well as it got picked up really big in America, obviously because of the link. And for all, it was, the coverage itself was great, and every piece of coverage, Kingsford Capital Management got mentioned, and it was just such a perfect storm. And yeah, it went everywhere. Kingsley ended up on the front of 442 with me in the suit, so I was technically in 442.
Got our friend at home.
Yeah. You know, it was in The Guardian. The Guardian did a whole feature on it in G2. It was just incredible. What it enabled us to do, it suddenly gave such a buzz around the club that enabled us to completely suddenly we were supposed to be doing a strip launch that was going to take place at the stadium with four or five players and nobody else. Suddenly we were able to do that in George Square and had 300 Thistle fans at and take over George Square for an afternoon, where all that was happening was Kingsley was appearing. Ryan Stevenson appeared, Dools appeared, Thomas Cherney, we just signed him as well. So it was, there was a couple of others, there was three or four brand new signings who had done nothing, and all any Thistle fan wanted to do was see Kingsley and have that picture taken with Kingsley. It was crackers, and it just kept going. And even now, every now and then I'll get a tweet saying, oh, Kingsley's appeared in, you know, the Singapore Times or the Melbourne Herald or something, and we even now we get more requests for Kingsley than we do for players, and that's what, 3 years on, 4 years on. It was amazing. It was just one of those waves that you just had to surf. And again, it was kind of similar to the England thing. It was a perfect storm. It was a quiet summer. There wasn't a lot going on. Wasn't many big signings happening, particularly in Scotland. It was a good story that backed up it had a really good, strong image. And it just captured the imagination. It was something a bit different. That was the overall phrase that probably used more than anything else, talking to journalists, talking to PR professionals. It was something a bit different at a time when there really wasn't much different going on. And it just worked brilliantly. In amongst it all, I had knee surgery, so I was hobbling around. You know, 48 hours after we launched it, I had knee surgery, and I was hobbling around George Square on crutches, having had knee reconstruction, trying to shepherd players into journalists and journalists into players, and having Kingsley chasing kids over. And that, it was crackers. It was absolutely bonkers, but it was really, really good. And it was a special season as well, because Kingsford really bought into it. They did these artist giveaways where they commissioned proper bits of art, essentially, that were given away to fans. You know, we produced 2,000 special team photos. We had big yellow hands produced by David Shrigley. We had special scarves made, and it just had a really nice feeling about it. And it was something pretty special to be involved with. And really is, I've been on holiday. In fact, that year, just before we launched, I'd been on holiday visiting friends in Chicago, and had been talking to them about what I had, what was going on at work, and what I had planned. And at that point, it was just a main sponsorship deal launch, and I mentioned it a couple of times because it'd been something we'd been working on for a couple of months. And I got a WhatsApp message from Lizzie and Ben saying that we've just been sat in a pub for a couple of hours, and your mascot's been on the screen four or five times. And you know, there are not many places in the world that haven't seen Kingsley, which is bizarre. Absolutely bizarre, but it was brilliant. It was great to be involved with. Absolutely brilliant, and just shows the power of a good story.
It shows the power of Twitter as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
For something just to catch fire and
just to catch fire. No, definitely, and it was a bit of a perfect storm, but we worked hard at managing it right, which helps. It was a good story. It was a good picture. It was a quiet time. All the things that I said there, and it worked. It worked really, really well.
We've got just maybe one question to ask in terms of tips or tricks or hints. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we want the podcast to cater for all levels of Scottish football. So what advice would you maybe give some of the smaller clubs looking to get a bit of extra coverage, or if there's anything from a typical match day that you can maybe impart your knowledge on to them?
In terms of trying to get more coverage, talk to your local journalists. Talk to, build relationships. I can absolutely promise, no matter what size a club is, if you reach out to a local journalist or a national journalist for that matter, they will try and make time for you, and they will try and make time to meet you. Talk to them, ask them what would work for them, ask them what you can do to make their lives easier, what can we do to get coverage, and they'll tell you. And to varying degrees, depending on where you are, it might be give us an exclusive player, or it might be can we get a couple of places of hospitality, or it might be can we get you to dress up in a tutu and pose next to your monster truck. You know, it could be any of these things. Gareth Lowe's a great one at the Sun they did some stuff with Falkirk last year. He was sat watching a game for your hot tub, for the top of a crane they had them. You know, it's all sorts. And now clubs might not want to do that, but every time Falkirk did that, they had a happy sponsor, because they were getting the front page of the Goal Supplement every time. So that would be it. Build relationships, reach out, and just talk to people. If you're not sure, ask the question. It's so much easier to ask a question of a journalist or of anybody. Ask the question, see what see what's right. Even now, I if I'm not sure about when I should host a press conference, I'll just pick up the phone, say, listen, should I put a Sunday player up here, or would 1 o'clock be okay for you guys then, or is 4 o'clock to do a new signing too late? Just ask the question. You'll not get laughed out of town. They'll actually really appreciate it. In terms of match days, there is only one rule on match day: stay calm. That is it. There is no that things will go wrong on a match day, whether it, from very very minor things like your printer breaking and not having any team sheet paper, to the power going off in the press box, which happened to us at our game on Tuesday night. There, you know, an hour before kickoff, and there's no power in the press box. Like, what do you do? Stay calm. There is nothing that will make a situation worse. And this is probably my general advice to anybody who works at an event. There is nothing that will make a situation worse than panicking and losing the plot. If you start shouting at folk, it's going to get worse. If you stay calm and work out the best, most rational way to get through it, that will keep you going pretty well in the right direction. And it's hard sometimes. It is really hard sometimes when all about you seems to be falling apart. We talk about fairly regularly, not regularly at Thistle, but once a season, you will have the game where everything goes wrong.
We've been asking our guests, not trying to put them on the spot too much, but what's the sort of best clubs or sports teams, organisations that you're following on social, or anybody individual wise that you stands out for you?
I think in Scotland there's a few. I mean, they get enough positives at the moment anyway, but I would say, I mean, Celtic do things pretty well. Celtic got resources to do some things really well, so with due respect to them, they've got no excuse not to do it well. I think the video content that comes out of Motherwell is spectacularly good. I think it's brilliant. I think that's what every club who produces any kind of video content aspires to. I think the guys through there are absolutely superb. I think what Killy have done recently in terms of just creating that community, that real strong identity for themselves, it's been helped by the fact that they've been tremendous on the pitch as well. You know, that always helps. But what they've created there has been really good. Phil Tillman at Hearts is useless. He's hopeless. Don't speak to him. No, the guys at Hearts are good as well. Really good to deal with from an external point of view. And I've had to deal with some tough situations in the last season or so. There's loads and loads of good stuff that's happening. Right the way from the ones we mentioned, Simpsons SPFL, things like that. That's great content. That's brilliant. Right the way up to the likes of Celtic, who are really kind of really nailing it. And what's really interesting at the moment, the new things that are coming through, #United, these kind of things that are really interesting and very, very, very different. Nobody's done that kind of thing before. And a lot of people, including myself, are still trying to get your heads around, well, what is this? Well, how does this work? What is this? And, you know, I defy any social media or communications manager to say that they don't sit and troll through Twitter and pick out the best bits and steal them for themselves, because it definitely happens, and that's what social media is about, is trying to replicate that good content. So there's loads out there, though, absolutely loads out there from every level of budget and every level of organisation.
We wrap up the podcast normally just by highlighting a couple of things from the world of sport that we quite like. Chris, do you want to?
Yeah, I've got a couple that are golf themed. Obviously we had the Open over the weekend. Last week I spotted the European Tour Twitter account was reliving the last round of the 1999 Open. Obviously Paul Laurie won that one, so a bit of a Scottish feel as well. But kind of complete with clips, images. I thought that was quite cool.
They did something similar. What would have happened during the 1995 Open if Twitter was around? Yeah. And it was the Rocca versus John Daly, when Costantino Rocca sinks that massive pat after he fluffs his chip. And it was brilliantly executed. And to be fair, we've talked about European Tour before, but yeah.
Some of that kind of stuff's brilliant. We did something fairly similar. We had a game at Tynecastle called off three seasons ago maybe. And one of the best games, or the best atmospheres, and certainly if you ask the manager what his best game has been since he's been in charge, it was in the first season up at Tynecastle. We beat Hearts 4-2 to secure our place in the league, and we had the game called off, and we decided, instead of just having a day off, we kind of retweeted the key. We tweeted out the key moments of this amazing victory that we had at Tynecastle, and we got some great reaction from Thistle fans who really got involved with it. I think a few had been in, probably in pubs outside Tynecastle when it got called off. Really had fun with it. Of course, what we got for Hearts fans was a little bit different. But yeah, things like that. I think things like that, again, it's innovative for social media. It's brilliant.
Definitely. If you look at like past old matches as well, like I said, there's so many examples you could pick from too. My final one would be Phil Mickelson. I don't know if you spotted this from the Open Twitter account, where he ridiculously chips a ball over somebody's head from about two feet away, I would say, maybe even less.
Yeah.
A massive flop shot. I think it's approaching 500,000 views on that initial video that got put up now, and it obviously kind of blew up across. It got stolen by all the various Twitter accounts that we always see stealing the content. So, I mean, you can't really argue with 500,000 views.
I might be wrong, but I think that was also a partner, because they filmed it from a different side as well. So there's obviously, again, going back to sponsor content, that
getting some value. Yeah,
it's such a simple idea, but it just can't. Yeah, it's kind of,
exactly,
in a way, it's like Kingsley. It's a simple idea. It's not something that you necessarily would think would be hugely popular, but it just works. It captures a bit of imagination, and as I say, somewhere along the line there'll be a super super happy sponsor.
Couple of quick ones from me then, talking sponsor content, etc. Inverness, obviously, at the weekend that just passed. Well, we're recording this just after the Open, and after the weekend of Inverness had their biggest home game, working with one of their partners there. They've had it on an annual basis, and I think I just wanted to highlight the fact that Inverness as a club get behind it. They could just do 100 kids on a pitch and play it, but Inverness actually go out their way to do video content around it, get the players, managers involved. John Robertson's really good at that side of things. I think last year he did a post-match interview going through where they lost the game, etc. This year it was about the build-up and the conference, a press conference and team talks and all that side of things. I think it's just great where you see a club that will go that little bit extra further for their sponsor, but also realise the benefit of the extra content that they're getting out of it. And the coverage that they can get. So I just wanted to flag that one. And also, I've been doing the rounds, and although they did really well, Watford obviously released their away kit by sending it to every fan that went home and away. Again, not an original idea. I think Southampton did it last month. They sent it to every fan that went home and away.
We mentioned the Brentford example as well.
Brentford have done it. They were doing it again, and I might as well blow our own trumpet when you get a chance. We did it with fans that have joined the supporters club in all around the world, America, Australia, Hong Kong, etc. And okay, we couldn't cater to every single fan that's not in Scotland, because it's actually quite a large number. But again, a simple concept that can help fans feel that a little bit extra value, and you get fans tweeting about it, and then all of a sudden it gets extra coverage.
I do love an interesting kit launch, because it's the kind of thing that becomes so formulaic. I don't know if you saw Everton launched their kit with their women's team, which, you know, it's a very, very simple idea, very worthwhile idea, and it got great coverage, really good, went quite big on social as well. So just those little different things that you can do, most people don't think about. So
he said Altmar and Netherlands, they used their esports player to launch their away kit.
Is that right?
Yeah.
No. The future.
Didn't even bother about the current the actual football players. They just went straight to the esports.
It's the future.
And the guy justified it all, and it made sense to why they went down that line. So, we'll maybe touch on esports in another podcast at some point as well. But conscious, that was a really good podcast.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for coming on. Chris, thanks again, and we'll be back again.